You're listening to Radio Netherlands, the Dutch International Service. We now present the second programme in our series Microchips Yes, Potato Chips No. The programme is presented by Jaldeep Katwala.
People on the left of the room go boom. People on the right of the room go boom.
Business is quite literally booming in India these days. Everywhere there are signs that the sleeping tiger of Asia is waking. And the key word is liberalization. In 1991, the government decided to open the doors to foreign investors. And since then, business has quite literally been booming. And good times have rolled for some, especially the middle classes, for theirs has been the loudest and shrillest voice for change. But there are those who say no. India must not go the way of the world, that international trade brings with it danger, that India's values are being eroded. They say consumerism is going to kill India. So who's right? Can India bury its head in the sands of international trade and just forget about everyone else? Or was liberalizing the economy the only way forward? I'm at Gwalior Tank, a rare splash of green in the heart of Bombay. It was from here that Mahatma Gandhi issued his famous call for the British to quit India on the 9th of August 1942. A pink lotus carved in stone sits atop a marble plinth to remember that day. Gandhi preached a mantra of self-reliance, and for 50 years India stood alone. The power of the multinational was tamed. Coca-Cola was kicked out of India. That was then, and this is now. The frustrated motorists you hear in the background blaring their horns are driving cars and riding bikes designed by the Japanese. And everywhere you see signs for Coca-Cola and Pepsi. The mantra now is no longer quit India, it is namaste. Welcome. That welcome is evident in Bridge Road in Bangalore. India's first Kentucky Fried Chicken outlet is found here, in one of the city's shopping streets. But there is a price to pay. 15 police sit in a bus outside the restaurant to protect it and its customers from attack. Early this year, the place was wrecked in a protest led by the Karnataka State Farmers Association. They were angered by what they fear is the devastating impact KFC could have on Indian agriculture and livestock. Now, I'm just old enough to remember the time when American fast food chains first appeared in Europe, and I can't recall violent protests of the kind seen in Bangalore. So why in India? And is it really possible for anyone to shut the door in the face of multinationals when it's already been opened? In a house in the western suburbs of Bangalore, I find K. Nanjundaswamy, the president of the association. His living room is remarkable for two things. There is no television here, and behind his desk, there's a portrait of Mahatma Gandhi. Nanjundaswamy describes himself as a Gandhian heretic.
Well, Gandhiji used to say, even during the first freedom movement, when people around him tried to discourage him, that one man is enough. And that's how a movement starts. And this is just the beginning of a movement.
Is it within your power to stop people like KFC and the other multinationals?
Well, the money power of multinational corporations is no match against people's power. Well, we could drive out the British without weapons. And now the situation is totally different. We don't need so much time, which Gandhiji took, to drive out the Britishers. I think we need a shorter time.
Is it your fear that what are called often traditional Indian values are at stake because of the arrival of people like Pepsi, Coke, like Kentucky Fried Chicken, and all the rest?
Well, definitely yes. They're a direct threat to Indian culture. I wouldn't like to see a world with a monoculture. I would like to see a world with cultural diversity. For example, I would like to see a Japan with Japanese culture, and not a Japan without Japanese culture. Well, same thing holds good for any other country.
Do you think that multinational culture, if you like, and traditional Indian culture can live together?
It's impossible. It's definitely impossible. Indian culture is several thousand years old, and this multinational culture is just about 300 or 400 years old. It makes a lot of difference. And when once you lose Indian culture, you can't get it back.
But inside the Kentucky Fried Chicken restaurant in Bangalore, evidence that Nanjundaswamy's opinion is ignored by many. People come from as far as Madras, about 250 kilometers away, just to sample what's on offer here. As customers munch away on their chicken wings and drumsticks, do they feel as if what they're doing is wrong?
I 100% totally disagree with that concept, because we are living in a global situation today, so we cannot narrow ourselves down and be very communal or ingrown. I call this ingrown toenailism, and we should get away from that. And we depend on multinationals for many things, and Kentucky Fried Chicken is a very small matter. And I don't think anyone should interfere in what we eat. And there are bigger issues to deal with than this very insignificant, minuscule problem.
Lal Gedvani said microchips, yes, potato chips, no. Is it possible to have both?
Why not? Why not? Sure. I think he himself would, in his heart of hearts, believe it. That's only a political gimmick talk. That's what I personally feel. I think no one should interfere with our eating habits. And once we know whatever facts there are, and we still go ahead, I think we are at full liberty. And this place is much cleaner than many of the restaurants that we find here in Bangalore or any part of India. So I don't really feel that this so-called multinational domination is of any consequence.
Fast food culture in India is part of a wider canvas of change, which has also seen the rise and rise of the middle class, estimated at more than 200 million people. It all began with the liberalisation of the Indian economy in 1991. What's also been noticeable and remarkable is the advent of consumerism. At Hindustan Thompson Associates, an advertising agency in Bombay, they've been part of this trend, and they've also seen how things have changed in India. Meera Patwardhan is the Director of Strategic Planning at the agency.
I think we've seen more change in India in the past 3 years than we've perhaps seen in the past 30 years that have gone before it. Consumers have been, in a very short span of just 3 years, we've seen the opening up of satellite television, foreign television that's coming into the increase in number of channels of television, and more world-famous global manufacturers have got interested in this country and have actually come in.
How have these changes affected the consumer? What is the consumer's mindset now?
I think there's been a wave of consumerism that's come into this country. And if I can just sum it up in one quote, India has changed from the old and the dutiful to the bold and the beautiful. It's really been, there's a sweeping materialism in the culture that's sort of driving over here. And I think the ancient caste system of Brahmins being the on the top of the heap is now changing to the nouveau riche and to the rich people being at the top of the heap. So having money is a way of saying, I have arrived. And that's the new status symbol. So having a cellular phone, having a pager, having a imported car or a foreign-made car, these are the signals that you send to say that I have money and I will spend.
What about the huge underclass that there must be? I mean, we're talking, say, 200 million middle class, 300 million people who aspire to middle class. How have their lives changed in the last few years?
I think television has really opened and started this whole drive for consuming. It's reached even the underclass. So you actually have, say, a strong middle class who is today has the means to buy most consumables and most durables. But you have a 300 million strong underclass, just below that middle class, who is looking at the goods and services that these people are buying. They're looking at television, and there is a very, very strong aspirational drive. And all these people are saying, I have bottled up my dreams for long enough. I want to buy today. So today and buying now is really the new credo.
Sir, Wheel of Fortune pehli baar Bharat mein. Song se shukr, roz. 72 deshon mein dhoom machane ke baad duniya ka number one game show, Sir, Wheel of Fortune. Sir, Wheel of Fortune ki sabse khaas baat.
And dreams are sold in a variety of ways. A few months ago, the Wheel of Fortune, an American game show where contestants spin a wheel, answer questions and win prizes, made its debut on Indian television, in Hindi. But there are other dreams for sale too. I once heard India described as a world where if you're rich, you can live in your house in the 21st century, but just outside your gate, you'll see the 17th century. Both exist side by side, without any apparent irony. The poor man at the gate dreams about living in the big house. And in the big house, they're all resident non-Indians. They live in India, but their hearts are somewhere else. I sit next to a poster seller at a busy traffic junction opposite Bombay University. His stock of posters is spread out on a low table to attract passers-by. A Mercedes estate car flashes by. You can buy one too, and people do, for 2.5 million rupees. That's about $80,000. A flat in a smart area of New Delhi will set you back $50 a month in rent. You can spend a night in a 4-star hotel in Bangalore for $65 a night. The poster seller has prints of horses running across mountain valleys, a wood in Scandinavia, a sunset on a beach by the ocean. These dreams are cheap. One poster sells for $1. If he's lucky, the poster seller might make as much as 200 rupees today, about $6. To my left, lottery tickets are being sold at 5 rupees a go. Top prize, 500,000 rupees, $1,500. And another Mercedes car flashes by. One of the tangible benefits of liberalization, for the middle classes anyway. I'm left with a worrying doubt. Is opening up the economy doing anything for the people at the bottom of the pile? Who will pay for their dreams? Dr. Amitabh Mukherjee is the director of the charity Action Aid India. He says liberalizing the economy has done little, if anything, for the poor. He tells me that 350 million people live below the poverty line in India. That means a family of five has an annual income of 11,000 rupees, less than $400.
As of now, if you see the scenario, the liberalization process hasn't improved the basic education in our villages, rural areas, where 70% of the people live. It has not improved the basic health facilities in the rural areas, where 70% of the people live. It has not improved the food availability situation. In fact, after the liberalization process, the food availability in the system has decreased. It has not done anything to develop the power sector. Up to now, I don't know if even 1 megawatt of power has been generated. The liberalization process has not yet contributed to the infrastructure development. Therefore, I would hazard a conclusion that the liberalization process hasn't really benefited these 350 million people who live below the poverty line. My fear is that if for 5 years or 7 years people remain malnourished, if for 5 years or 7 years the children who are in the age group of 5 to 10 do not get education, if for 5 to 7 years pregnant mothers do not get the required medical attention and support, then we will have lost a whole generation of people who will be malnourished, who will be sick, who will be undereducated. So that's a big loss to a nation.
There are few in India who will speak openly about the plight of the poor when the middle classes have so much to gain from liberalisation. But consumerism marches on regardless. India always was a very selfish society. There's no such thing as a social security system, no safety net for the poor. Now, as well as this selfishness, there's a Me Too culture. If Rajiv next door has a new car, I must have one too. If he buys a beeper or pager for $200, then so must I. If he gets a mobile phone, around $800, then what about me? It's summed up by a headline I saw in a newspaper, Keeping Up with the Joneses. There is in Britain a well-entrenched stereotype of the Indian corner shop, open most hours of the day, run by a family, where everyone, children included, help out to make the business run. It was people like my parents and I who lived out that stereotype, and to this day, I have a lot of sympathy for people who work and live like that. In a marketplace in Bombay, the stalls, wooden platforms on wheels, are piled high with vegetables and fruit. Customers walk by and lean over the stalls looking for a good buy. In my mother tongue, Gujarati, I ask one of the stallholders, Dilip, about himself. He says he's been running the store for 25 years. He sleeps at night on the road underneath his stall. He tells me he earns about 60 rupees a day, $2, but it depends on how busy the market is. It's a very traditional way of doing business in India. It's been like this for hundreds, if not thousands of years. Then, a few years ago, small stores like this one opened up. There's a long counter at the front. The storekeeper sits behind it, and then behind him are groceries, pulses, cereals and the like. Kiran Keshavji says what customers want these days is different.
Yeah, things have changed in the sense that people are more and more going for more brands. And also they are going for packaged items. Earlier times, it used to be sold in loose packs, you know, and weighed in front of the customer. Now you have got pre-packs and you sell them in packets.
How important is the influence of things from outside of India in this process?
Quite important in the sense that as far as the food items go, they don't really matter that much, food items out of India. But in soaps, detergents, oils, toothpastes, etc., definitely people prefer to have the outside brands rather than the indigenous ones. It's good, but the problem as far as we, the dealers, are concerned, the profit margins are very, very low. But because of the customer demand, we do have to keep these things in our stores.
And this is the competition that traders like Keshavji fear the most. In Bangalore and in other big cities, supermarket culture has arrived. This store could be anywhere in the world. Shelves are piled high with imported and Indian brands of anything from apple slices to washing powders. And there is a price to pay. These are expensive places to shop in. And the people who come here are not the poor or even the slightly better off. No, this is a haunt of Bangalore's well-to-do. Sheila Kavle, a marketing consultant, explains that supermarket culture, unheard of when I first went to India in 1979, is a relatively recent phenomenon.
I would say for the last 5 or 10 years, the upmarket, the middle market, has created a necessity for big retailers to understand that we want to shop at leisure. And in a lot of cases, a lot of us who have been all over the world don't like to be disturbed, you know, for being told which brand to look at, which brand to buy.
And how is this different from traditional ways?
Unfortunately, the traditional way was very much a family-centered traditional way of looking at business, where you had, well, some points were very good from the family business point of view, as I personally feel the communication sense, the one-to-one knowledge or friendship with a family also contributed a lot to the PR. But then again, you really depended on a certain items that you had, and there was always a certain amount of push and pull.
What has been the difference in the range and the availability of products? I mean, what can you get now in places like this which you couldn't get 5 years ago?
Sometimes the choice is so much, especially with the multinationals being opened up, and quite rightly so, that we now have access to a variety of brands, whether it's lipsticks, room cleaners, fresheners, towels, toothpastes, even a simple thing like cornflakes. You have that ability to choose, and the customer cannot be fooled. It is not the brand name that the customer is looking for. I began with Mohan's cornflakes and I wound up with Kellogg's. Purely a matter of taste, purely a matter of choice. Yes, to some extent, I was very influenced by the PR and the press ads. But then again, the product is excellent. And so you don't mind paying that little extra. It's value for money.
Opening up India's economy has done more than create a consumer society. Business is booming for exporters. In the old days, they were faced with a licensed Raj. Bureaucracy ruled the business jungle, and it seemed that every single action needed some bureaucrat's permission in triplicate. At Namaste Exports, a leather goods manufacturer in Bangalore, a total of 4,000 people process animal skins into leather jackets and shoes. This company exports $35 million of completed goods every year. Narayan Bhatt, the chairman, remembers the old days before 1991, before liberalization.
There were a lot of restrictions, rules. So we were asked to run with our legs tied, hands tied. So we were not able to run. Today, Those things have been removed, and we are able to walk freely and work freely.
In the past, was it possible for you to close your companies down or close factories down if they weren't working, or to sack workers if you wanted to?
Yeah, in the past, it was not possible at all to close the factories and other things. But now, also it is not possible, but it's getting liberalized, and to a greater extent today, closing down the factories, if it is not running properly, has been treated not as a sin, but as a necessity.
And old habits die hard. There is still the idea in India that an employer treats workers as if they're part of some huge extended family, that a job is for life, except for serious misdemeanors. The employer has a social conscience. And it's particularly noticeable in state-run concerns like Indian Railways, which has 1 million employees. When you travel by train, it's not difficult to see why. It seems there are far more staff running the network than you would find in Europe. So how did the massive public sector ethos develop, and how long can it last? The projects director of the All India Management Association is Maniraj Gera.
It has been like this for ages, really, because our people are underemployed and they're also underpaid. So therefore, the combination of both is not so much backbreaking for an employer. There's a lot of scope for our people improving their productivity. And now that the business is likely to expand in the liberalized environment, instead of sacking people, it will be the attempt of all employers, whether it be in public or private sector, to see that the people who are underpaid and who are underemployed with them, they get to perform better and they are, you know, made to adopt more productive manner of operating. In the ultimate analysis, it will lead to no unemployment, no extra unemployment.
How is it then possible for India to compete with companies, other countries on a global stage, when other companies in other parts of the world can hire and fire in some countries at will? They can just sack people as and when they need to.
The companies are not only competing with their services, they're also competing for their people. The people there are getting their market value, while people in India, the employees in India, they are not getting their market value. They are being underpaid. And therefore, when you have an organization with the underpaid people, then an organization has a better chance of competing with those who might be comparatively more competent, but they all have to be paid at the market rate there.
But there are places where things are different. In India's Silicon Valley, Bangalore, in a computer software company, the employees know that a job isn't for life, that you're only as good as your last project. Hire and fire is the norm, not an exception. Murali Parthasarathy describes how it's different here in other ways too.
It's a very flat structure. We cannot afford to have too many hierarchies. Decisions have to be made quickly. So I can walk into anybody's room at any point of time and talk about anything, and there's nothing to stop me from that. Most offices you'll see do not have separate cabins or cubicles for managers. And even if they do have separate cubicles, it's always an open door policy. So you can walk in any time.
One thing I've noticed looking around the place is that people here seem to be much younger and probably much more confident about themselves and what they're doing.
Yeah, most definitely, because the IT industry is so young in India. I would say it started somewhere around the early 80s, and it's a developing industry. It's not something which has been around for a long time in India. And the confidence level is mainly because of the educational background of the people. Most of the people in the IT industry are graduates. Many of them are professional graduates. So as far as it comes to their technical ability, there's a great deal of confidence in their technical abilities. I mean, they may lack on certain things like communication skills and things like that, but they make up for that with their sheer technical knowledge.
Is this place any different from the way a computer company would be, say, in the States or in Europe? Is there anything intrinsically Indian about an Indian computer company?
Yes. One thing which comes to mind is the infrastructure, which is definitely at a much... it needs to develop a lot in an Indian IT company when compared with the one in the Western countries. And it's especially more important for an IT industry to have good infrastructure because of the amount of time that any individual puts into. The amount of time that they spend in their offices is much more. And nobody in India, no industry in India has ever paid much attention to the workplace and the amount of time, money that they invest in their facilities. But I think it's changing because, for example, we have one company in Bangalore which they've spent an enormous amount of money, and they've modeled it on the lines of a university, much like the Microsoft headquarters. And there's another in Bombay, which is supposed to be a high-tech office, where even the amount of sunlight which enters the building is monitored by a computer. So it's changing, and I think the IT industry is what is bringing the change in.
Nowadays, if it's made in India, the chances are that it's been done in a joint venture with a multinational. The middle classes and their money have ensured that India is just another marketplace ripe for profit and exploitation. But who will champion the poor who have no money and no prospects in this new shiny brassy place I can no longer call my India?
You've been listening to the second programme in our series Microchips Yes, Potato Chips No. The programme was produced and presented by Jaldeep Katwala. Technical production was by Floris von Horn. This has been a Radio Netherlands presentation.